day to order at 9:04. We're going to start off today with House Bill 404.
All right. Let's
see. And this is a legislation from Representative Sponholz and her staff, Chelsea Ward Waller. Does the sponsor wish to make additional comments, or do committee members have questions for the bill sponsor?
So I'll just make a couple of comments. So we adopted a committee substitute on Monday, which made some changes that were at the recommendation of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. They wanted to make sure that the dividend remained on the books, that this was a really important part of ensuring that AHSC's bond rating nationally remains very high, which keeps our rates very low in Alaska and allows them to be really effective. And in working with them, we updated the language on Monday to say that the dividend would be designated for affordable and workforce housing. And this is really important because we heard in our housing hearing on March 25th that we have a housing crisis in Alaska, and it is a statewide problem. It is a strategic problem for the military and Fairbanks, where we need housing to be upgraded to be able to meet the military standards so that we can make sure that we're housing all those F-35, airmen and their families. It's an issue in Anchorage, where the average home now is $420,000, which is way outside of the affordable range for average working families on average income. There is some other legislation under another effort under consideration to create a housing trust. This would complement. It's not instead of. It's not in place of. But what we do know is that in recent years, when budgets have been tight, instead of spending the dividend on workforce and affordable housing, we've been spending it on, you know, DOT match and Department of Law and DNR and DEC funding. And all of those things are important. But now we're at a point where we've got a crisis in housing in the state of Alaska. And so this is a small measure that will ensure that AHFC will continue to be effective moving forward, but that we can also start to make those strategic, you know, increase our strategic investments without increasing overhead for the state of Alaska. AHFC already has effective programs. We don't need to create new programs. This would just be turning up the dose, essentially, on AHFC's investment in affordable and workforce housing that they already do really, really well in Alaska.
Thank you. And Stacey Barnes with AHFC is online. If members have questions for AHFC. Not seeing any questions, I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 404. Is anyone in the room to provide public testimony on House Bill 404? I don't think so. I think Brittany Smart may be online to provide public testimony. Ms. Smart, would you like to go ahead with your testimony?
Good morning, committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today, and thank you to Representative Sponholz for putting this bill forward. My name is Brittany Smart, calling from the Fairbanks North Star Borough. I'm Special Assistant to Mayor Ward here at the borough, and I've been the point of contact that's been working on the military housing issue in our community. I want to start by saying that neither the Assembly or administration has taken a formal stance on this bill. However, we are extremely grateful that the state is looking at options before them to help address the housing issue, not just in our community, but statewide. As Rep. Sponholz noted, housing is a challenge, not just across the state, but nationwide as well. And it behooves us to look at the tools that we have before us to help our communities meet this need. So just wanted to call in and say thank you to the state for looking at options, and we look forward to working with you moving forward on various options to address housing at the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smart. And as Representative Sponholz mentioned, we're also working on a housing trust fund concept, and I think both of us are probably happy to talk to you more about that offline. Do members have questions for Ms. Smart? Not seeing any. Ms. Barnes, you're online just for questions, or do you want to offer public testimony? I think Ms. Barnes is online just for questions. Just want to confirm. Is there anyone else online for public testimony? Not seeing any. I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 404. And with that, I think we can take action on the bill. Representative Sponholz, do you have a motion?
Chair Fields, I move House Bill 404 version 32-LS1638-I from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Not seeing any objection, House Bill 404 passes from the House Labor and Commerce Committee, and please sign the paperwork as it circulates. Next, we're going to go to hearings for governor's appointees, and then we'll turn to House Bills 405, 406, and 408. For governor's appointees, we're going to start with the Board of Pharmacy. We have three appointees, Tom Wadsworth, Rod Gordon, and Dan Nelson. Let's start with Mr. Wadsworth. Mr. Wadsworth, please proceed with your testimony, and if you could limit your testimony to 2 minutes, we'll have time to get through all the appointees.
Yes, this is Tom Wadsworth. I'm here. I'm an Alaska pharmacist of 20 years. My opinion that I'm about to express today is expressly my own opinion and doesn't represent the opinions of or positions of my employer. With that said, I'm rising in opposition to the appointment of Ramsey Bell to the Alaska Board of Pharmacy. The Board of Pharmacy is statutorily mandated to establish and enforce professional standards and competence and rules of conduct for our profession in the state. And those members of the board really should be experienced pharmacists that demonstrate competence and commitment to evidence-based best practices and standards of patient care. A cursory review of Ramsey Bell's social media posts over the last few years will demonstrate what I would call an extreme politicized and conspiratorial views that are strongly at variance with our established time-proven standards and best practices in our profession. And the sentiments and misinterpreted information that she consistently expressed is in direct contradiction to the mission of the Board of Pharmacy. And I would say that she's demonstrated time and time again her inability to interpret medical literature and then politicizing that misinformation or misinterpretation to promote conspiracy theories and disparage the very profession for which she now seeks to represent and regulate. So Ramsey Bell clearly represents what I would call a heretical point of view or viewpoint with the intent of imposing those views through the Board of Pharmacy in its regulations. She's absolutely not the right person for this position. In fact, she is the epitome of who should not be appointed to this regulatory board or otherwise representing our profession, much less regulating it. I strongly oppose her appointment to the Board of Pharmacy in Alaska, and I ask for your support in that opposition. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Wadsworth. And it was actually my error. I should have turned to Ramsey Bell for testimony and then opened public testimony on her appointment. So, Mr. Wadsworth, I think your testimony will fall into the public testimony on Ms. Bell's potential appointment. This time I'm going to go to Ms. Bell to talk to the committee, and then we'll turn back to individuals who may wish to testify about her appointment. And I apologize for going in the wrong order, but thanks for your testimony, Mr. Wadsworth. Ramsey Bell, if you're online, if you could provide testimony about your appointment to the committee.
Yes, hi, thank you so much. I'm Ramsey Bell, Alaskan pharmacist in good standing with over 22 years of experience. A wife, mom of two boys, we're a cocky, travel, food, adventure-loving family who moved to Alaska from Illinois about 5 years ago. I love to read, build, make things, bring people joy through making them food, and laugh and be silly with my kids. I value truth over comfort, which I believe is perhaps the biggest asset I bring to this appointment. And I'll come back to that in a moment. My love for pharmacy and health started early. I guess my mom tells the story that I came home from a career fair in sixth grade and declared that I was going to be a pharmacist, and I haven't looked back since. I graduated from Purdue in 2000, started working in retail pharmacy immediately upon graduation and licensure. I've always thought out ways in which I could give more to my profession and patients, and was promoted to pharmacy manager within 9 months of graduating because of my drive to serve. Over time, I became known as the pharmacy fixer in the company that I worked for because of my skills in talent management and processes. I drove to struggling pharmacies all over Illinois and Indiana to address team, inventory, workflow, and profitability issues, all while still managing successfully my home-based pharmacy. I knew early on that I wanted to serve my community and profession of pharmacy in a bigger way, but running for public office or a position in the State Board of Pharmacy in Illinois is a much different ballgame. It's much less welcoming and community-oriented and much more about who you know and how much money you have. When we moved to Alaska, I welcomed the closeness and community and the support of all things local here. I was excited to learn of this position on the Board of Pharmacy when it opened up and didn't hesitate to apply. I'm ready to serve Alaskans and the profession of pharmacy in general, and I think I will bring several things to the table that set me apart from others. First, reinforces my ability to effectively communicate and work with people from a multitude of diverse backgrounds, personalities, beliefs, and styles of communication. My communication style is one that is based on seeking to understand, engaging in learning and conversation, always with openness, diplomacy, and respect. Mr. Wadsworth, I was surprised to hear his testimony as a pharmacy where I work, which I do not represent today, I represent only myself. I was surprised to hear his testimony because we have worked closely with the School of Pharmacy here in Alaska for vaccination clinics for the past year. I have worked respectfully and successfully with many members of the staff and students and have never once been approached by him with any concern for my ability to serve my public or my profession. In fact, he was in the pharmacy where I work this week and did not one time ask me a single question about myself or about any of the issues he seems to bring of concern today. I would have welcomed that discussion as I always have. Which brings me to my second point. Another thing that I bring to the table is my desire to seek and share, the first thing is my ability to effectively communicate with people from a multitude of diverse backgrounds, personalities, beliefs, and styles of communication, regardless of how they feel about me. My style of communication will always be one of openness, diplomacy, and respect. Second is my desire to seek and share truth, regardless of the discomfort that it brings to others or the attack that it may bring upon myself. As you know, and as Tom mentioned, I've spoken openly over the past 2 years about my support of several things that for some reason have been labeled as controversial. I have always believed in early treatments for all health conditions. I have always believed in off-label uses of drugs, as 30% of every prescription that we fill in the pharmacy is for an off-label use of a medication. Those beliefs and importance of those two concepts are not just limited to COVID. I firmly believe in every person's right to decide with their health provider what is best for them. My belief in that is also not limited to COVID. I believe in fully formed consent regarding all medical treatments, including vaccinations, and again, not just as it relates to COVID. Sharing information on these concepts over the past 2 years have brought endless attacks, and I could have easily stayed silent. I'm sure there will be more attacks to come today. I've never been one to back down from opening up dialogue because I was scared of what people would say or think. I continue to advocate for what is right regardless. I continue to discuss points and relevant information because discussion is how we all learn and get better. When we know better, we do better. It would be easy for me to call people who feel differently than I do or who have different styles of discussion names, such as conspiracy theorists, but I don't do that. I have more respect for people than that. It would have been super easy for me to scrub my social media once I was appointed to this position. In fact, it was suggested by several people. But then you wouldn't get the full authentic picture of who I am and what I stand for. You would have no idea how I present topics. It might in some situations be controversial, but I can present information and invite discussion without disrespect, name-calling, arguing. You would have no idea how I handle controversy. I invite you to go check out my social media. Please do so. You will see many things about me, the most of which is my optimism, my ability to communicate and find silver linings. Healthcare and pharmacy will never be one size fits all, and I will never advocate for a solution that indicates that that's the case. Our society has moved in a direction where many things, as we see today, including healthcare discussions, are viewed as political. And as a result, the public's trust in healthcare agencies and medical professionals, including pharmacists, has decreased significantly, in part due to a lack of transparency, respect, and discussion. In my role in the Board of Pharmacy, I want to help restore the public's trust in healthcare. I want to restore the respect, transparency, and discussion that is such an important part of pharmacy and healthcare. I will honor and serve the people of Alaska to the best of my ability, regardless of the attacks that come at me from people who claim to be my peers. And I will not let you down. Thank you for your time and consideration for this appointment.
Thanks, Ms. Bell. Do committee members have questions for Ms. Bell? Not seeing any this time, I'm going to open public testimony on Ms. Bell's appointment, and again, we'll include Mr. Wadsworth. Wadsworth's previous comments in that public testimony opening public testimony. I think Rod Gordon from Anchorage, are you here to provide public testimony on the potential appointment of Ramsey Bell to the Board of Pharmacy?
Yes, hopefully you can hear me okay.
We can. Please proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Rod Gordon. I'm a pharmacist, and I live and work here in Alaska. I have done so for the past 22 years. I've had the privilege of being a pharmacist for 42 years. I think that's one of the oldest pharmacists actually in the state. And over that period of time, I've worked across the country from the East Coast to Nome and Barrow and even the Virgin Islands, even Saudi Arabia. So I've worked all over this planet essentially doing pharmacy work to take care of patients and to try to do what's in their best interest. And, you know, when you have an opportunity like we have today to consider the appointment of someone to the Board of Pharmacy, I think we have two choices. We can either stay silent and just let the whatever wheels move happen and just let the appointment go and not be concerned regardless, or you can speak up and take action. And that's what I'm choosing to do today. And the reasons that I do that is because the Board of Pharmacy matters. It actually matters in how pharmacy is provided in the state of Alaska. And I echo the sentiments from Tom Wadsworth in that, Mike, I have serious concerns that Ramsey Bell may not be the best person for this position. And that is based on an understanding of what she has said in her public media posts. You know, the most important thing for a Board of Pharmacy person is that they have their primary concern be for the public, general public safety and health. And I don't think, based on the views that she's expressed in her social media posts, that she represents that person. A person who's ideal for that position would not be easily influenced by political views or pressures or by public sentiments favoring one particular position over another. A person on the board needs to have a mindset that's based on objective, data-driven science and evidence-based medicine, and it's not influenced by political bias. And, you know, Ramsey made the comments about the importance of being able to use drugs off-label, but you have to realize in pharmacy, when we use drugs off-label, it's only appropriate to do that when there's clinical data to support the safety and the efficacy of that drug. And the pharmacist is the last person in the whole line of people who are available to protect the person receiving that medication for an off-label use that could be harmful to the patient. And I don't think the views that she's represented on social media, which, to be specific, was in regarding a strong support for the use of ivermectin, which is a drug used to treat parasites, for the treatment of COVID back in February of 2021. And she said that it's unfortunately, she says, it's either due to ignorant or deceitful interests, essentially, that includes people in the hospital who are responsible for treating others with COVID and pharmacists who stand in the way of the doctor-patient relationship by refusing to fill ivermectin prescriptions. And then she went on to say in a subsequent post that the reason that the CDC had restricted the use of monoclonal antibodies was because of essentially a financial bias favoring Pfizer and Merck's oral medications, and that it's a concern for essentially boosting the bottom line of pharmaceutical companies. And that is not the mindset of a person who puts objective science, evidence-based medicine at the forefront, and we don't really need that on the Board of Pharmacy. And with that, I'll just conclude to say that I think we should look long and hard before we just vote for Ramsey today. We should consider really what's the best thing for this, for our state and for the Board of Pharmacy, and think about another appointment. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Gordon. Do committee members have questions for Mr. Gordon? Next up in public testimony is Dan Nelson. Mr. Nelson, please proceed.
Hey, Doug, can you hear me okay?
We can.
Thank you, hello, Chair Fields and Co-Chair Sponholz. Appreciate the opportunity to provide public comment today regarding the appointment of Ramsey Bell, or the confirmation of Ramsey Bell to the Board of Pharmacy. My name is Dan Nelson again. I'm a pharmacist in Fairbanks, currently working in Tok. I'm calling in on behalf of myself as a concerned pharmacist of 20 years in the state of Alaska, and also on behalf of my employer, Tanma Chase Conference. As you all well know, we've been through a tremendous rollercoaster highs and lows over the last 2 years in healthcare and public health worlds. Alaska Natives have been particularly hard hit by the effects of the COVID pandemic, with higher rates of things like hospitalizations, death, and other long-term effects. Throughout the course of the pandemic, medical and scientific knowledge and information have continued to change, grow, and improve as additional studies have been completed and analyzed. It is clear that what we thought we knew has often proved to be incorrect or otherwise changed over time. That has led to an ever-changing landscape of medical literature, best practices, and clinical guidelines. However, what has not changed is the underpinning of it all, and that is that all medical professions, pharmacy in particular, are trained in and grounded by a foundation that is based in evidence-based medicine, also known as science. From the development of new vaccines to exciting new therapeutic options like monoclonal antibodies and oral antivirals that were specifically designed to treat SARS-CoV-2 virus, we are all living in an era of breakneck medical changes and updates. In light of the pace of changes, things can and do become quite confusing. Unfortunately, things have also been unmoored from their scientific bases and morphed into political-based ideology. At the end of the day, we need to go back to the basics and look at what the scientific evidence tells us to make our medical decisions and recommendations. That being said, I unfortunately feel that Ramsey Bell has gotten off track in her approach to the practice of pharmacy. Her approach to the literature evaluation and application of that evaluation is not in line with professional standards. Frankly, her misinterpretation of current medical literature is not in the best interest of the residents of the state of Alaska and is dangerous to the Alaska Native and American Indian communities of our great state. Because of these concerns, I would encourage you to not vote in favor of Ms. Bell's confirmation when the appropriate time comes. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Nelson. Do committee members have questions for Mr. Nelson? Okay, before we move on to the next appointees, Ms. Bell, I do just want to let you know that I'm not able to support your confirmation. I've let the governor's staff know that. I wouldn't want it to come as a surprise, and it's for many of the reasons stated by the testifiers. Next up in governor's appointees, Board of Massage Therapists. First up, we have appointee Amanda Nosich. Ms. Nosich, please proceed.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today. This would not be my first appointment to the Massage Therapy Board. I served directly after its conception and to the term then, and have taken a break. And I'm back and ready to serve again. I've had extensive relationship with this bill from its conception, going through the state and representing it to other massage therapists and to the public. I'm happy to serve again, and I'm open to any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Nosich. Do committee members have questions? Not seeing any. Next up is appointee Kelly Shu. Excuse me. Please proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Kelly Shu. I've been a massage therapist since 2011. I'm originally licensed in another state and then moving up here in 2013. I'm looking forward to serving on the Board of Massage Therapy to help protect the public and therapists and help advance the massage therapy profession. I have worked in a variety of different settings and types of employment, so I feel I'm versed in how a lot of any issues would affect fellow massage therapist, and I appreciate your consideration for this appointment.
Thank you, Ms. Shu. Do committee members have questions? I'm not seeing any. Next up in appointees is Dominic Wenzel with the Board of Dental Examiners. Mr. Wenzel, please proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the time this morning. My name is Dominic Wenzel. A little background on my education. I received a dual degree from Oregon State University in general science with a minor in zoology and political science with a minor in American government. I graduated with my doctorate from Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland. Before I was actually appointed to the board the first time, I was chairman of the Alaska Dental Society peer review for 3 years. I was appointed by Governor Walker 4 years ago, so I've been asked to serve another 4 years, so I'm happy to do that. In addition to serving on the dental board currently, I am a dental licensing examiner for the Commission on Dental Competency Assessments and for the Western Regional Examining Board. I believe in patient protection through self-regulation, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mr. Wenzel. Do committee members have questions? Not seeing any. Next up, we're going to go to the Board of Nursing. Jody Miller, would you like to proceed with your testimony?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Jody Miller, and I've been appointed to represent the LPN on the Board of Nursing. I grew up in Michigan. I have over 42 years of nursing experience, a wide variety, worked the emergency room, critical care, worked in Michigan for 12 years. My husband and I moved to Juneau, where I worked at Bartlett for 5 years, and then we moved to Haines, and I have been working here with Search since 1994. I have a variety of background. I'm looking forward to serving and sharing my knowledge and experience and learning. There are different challenges between being a nurse in a hospital compared to a rural community, and I'm hoping that I can open that up to ease some of the challenges that we face. And I thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thanks, Ms. Miller. Do committee members have questions for Ms. Miller? Not seeing any. I think the final board and the final appointee who we're going to hear from today is Dr. Walter Campbell, appointee to the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Dr. Campbell, if you would like to proceed with your testimony.
Absolutely. My name is Dr. Walter Campbell. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I've been practicing chiropractic for 17 years in the state of Alaska. I'm humbled by the appointment and honored by the consideration. Be happy to answer any questions.
Do committee members have questions for Dr. Campbell? Not seeing any, I think that does conclude our consideration of governor's appointees. Thanks to everyone who called in to offer testimony. Next up today, we're going to move to House Bill 405, where we do have invited testimony from Kaisa DeBell with Global Financial Integrity. And the intention with providing some additional invited testimony today is to address what I think Representative Kaufman described as identifying the problem statement these bills attempt to address. So thanks, Ms. DeBell, for being here today. And if you're ready, you can proceed with your invited testimony.
Good morning, and thank you for letting me testify before you on this important issue of real estate opacity in Alaska. Just wanted to make sure that you can hear me all right.
Yes.
For the record, my name is Kaisa DeBell, and I am a policy analyst affiliated with Global Financial Integrity, or GFI. GFI is a Washington, D.C.-based think tank focused on providing evidence-based research and solutions to counter ways in which criminal actors abuse the U.S. economy to hide their illicit profits. Sanctioned governments, kleptocrats, and drug traffickers have long used the U.S. real estate sector as a vehicle to evade sanctions and hide their ill-gotten gains. Simply put, real estate is an attractive safe haven for illicit money because it retains value while also creating the opportunity for long-term profits through rentals, property flips, and land development. Most significantly, the U.S. real estate market permits anonymous purchase of real estate through shell companies and trusts. This makes it easy for bad actors and criminals to hide their identity and, in turn, protects their wealth from asset recovery efforts as well, both in their home jurisdiction and in countries where they are sanctioned. Recent investigative efforts like the Pandora Papers are just one in a long line of reports exposing high-profile real estate money laundering cases that span the country. Last year, GFI published a report that found that more than $2.3 billion was laundered through U.S. real estate in cases reported between 2015 and 2020. GFI's analysis of those cases shows two very clear trends. First, the most common money laundering technique in the real estate sector is the use of complex legal structures to purchase properties. The use of trusts and companies makes it easy for criminals to hide ownership of real estate, while at the same time being able to flaunt in plain sight the evidence of ill-gotten wealth. Sometimes these were companies and trusts registered domestically, but it also often featured companies registered abroad. A second trend found in GFI's analysis is that the U.S. real estate sector particularly attracts actors with political ties to foreign regimes, including adversaries like North Korea, Iran, and Venezuela. In 82% of the analyzed cases, the illicit money invested in the real estate sector had foreign origins. And in more than half of the cases, the beneficial owner of the property was a foreign politician or their associate who obtained their wealth through corrupt activities. This high influx of foreign and corrupt money poses a serious threat to U.S. national security and global democratic norms. Unfortunately, the Alaskan real estate market has not been excluded from this trend. For instance, between 2011 and 2014, an Alaskan resident helped the Iranian government transfer $1 billion to various businesses and individuals around the world in violation of the U.S. sanctions regime. This Alaskan resident received $10 million for his role in the scheme and laundered this money for real estate purchases in Alaska. Through various shell companies, he held more than 20 condominiums and homes in Anchorage and Eagle River. But despite these known risks across the country, real estate transactions are subject to limited federal oversight. The only binding federal regulation focused on real estate risks are geographic targeting orders, or GTOs. These temporary orders require title insurance companies to report the beneficial owner of real estate, residential real estate purchases, but they only apply in a select group of 22 counties across the country. This policy has several serious shortcomings and is inadequate to address real estate money laundering and sanctions evasion risks. First, the GTOs do not apply in Alaska. In fact, GFI's research found that the majority of real estate money laundering cases involve properties located outside of the GTO geographic scope, with Alaska proving to be one of the bigger real estate money laundering hubs, as you can see on this map. Even if the GTOs would apply in Alaska, it would be very easy to get around them because title insurance is only mandatory when the buyer takes out a loan. Kleptocrats, oligarchs, and high net worth criminals have plenty of cash at their disposal to acquire real estate without a loan or title insurance, thereby evading the GTOs. And while the Corporate Transparency Act, which was passed by Congress last year, will address some of the opacity in the U.S. real estate sector, it will not help in identifying the beneficial owner when a foreign company or trust buys real estate, which is just as common. Given these loopholes in the federal regulatory system, it is critical to seek solutions at the state level to address these gaps. GFI therefore supports House Bills 405 and 406 as an important step to address the opacity in the real estate sector in Alaska. To ensure that House Bill 406 brings greater transparency without loopholes for bad actors to exploit, GFI urges Alaska to incorporate the following policy recommendations. First, at a minimum, the basic goal of House Bill 406 should be to create a clear picture of the beneficial ownership of real estate in Alaska. The requirement of identifying the beneficial owner should apply to all legal entities buying real estate, including LLCs, trusts, and other legal entities formed and registered in the U.S. as well as abroad. Second, in addition to beneficial ownership, the source of funds and the identification of politically exposed persons should also be reported. These two additional key pieces of information are critical to spot red flags in a transaction and identify high-risk actors. Third, instead of putting the reporting burden on one gatekeeper, it should be placed on multiple real estate professionals in cascading order. This creates a shared responsibility among real estate professionals and prevents bad actors from evading the requirement by bypassing a title agent. Fourth and finally, the bill should apply to all real estate transactions that were not financed with the loan from U.S.-based financial institutions, because those are currently the only actors who are required under federal law to conduct any type of anti-money laundering checks in a real estate transaction in the U.S. These reforms would make House Bill 406 more effective, while at the same time ensure it has minimal costs on Alaskan real estate professionals. In conclusion, Alaska has the opportunity to counter the use of real estate as an easy mechanism for bad actors to evade sanctions, gain access to the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. financial system. And we encourage you to take this opportunity. Thank you again for your time today, and I look forward to any questions you may have.
Thanks, Ms. DeBell, and I encourage you to work with my staff on crafting amendments to tighten House Bill 406. I do have a question. Do you think it's fair to say that preventing money laundering and hiding, as you said, ill-gotten gains by sanctioned individuals requires both strong state and federal laws, or is it sufficient to sort of wait for the federal government?
I would say there's, thank you so much for your question through the chair. I would answer that question in two ways. First, there is important federal legislation underway. The Corporate Transparency Act was a very important step in addressing some of the issues of opacity in the real estate sector, and also the illicit use of legal entities such as LLCs and trusts generally. But some things remain unclear under this federal Corporate Transparency Act, and those are crucial issues. Under the Corporate Transparency Act, corporations, limited liability companies, and other similar entities formed and registered to do business in a U.S. state will be required to disclose their beneficial owner to a directly housed at the financial FinCEN. And that includes foreign companies, but only when they are registering in the U.S. to do business. And because of that qualification of the term to do business, it is unclear whether the use of foreign LLCs or trusts for the purchase of, for example, residential real estate would be covered by that, because that might not qualify as doing business. So that weakness means that if, for example, a Russian LLC or trust buys property in Alaska, that would not qualify as doing business and would therefore not necessarily be captured by federal legislation. Another loophole is that the application of the CTA to trusts remains unclear to this day. So it is very important, I think, that states are proactive about addressing that loophole with state-level legislation. Thank you.
Thanks. Do other committee members have questions for Ms. DeBell? I have an additional question, Ms. DeBell, and thanks for providing testimony on both House Bill 405 and 406, because they are related. I think, you know, a natural question people have is, we have sort of a window into how criminals exploit trusts and laundering money through real estate with the Pandora Papers. But of course, it's just one, it's sort of like looking through a telescope, you know, whatever you can see in the view is there, but there's a lot that we don't see. And I think it's fair to say we don't know the full extent to which criminals may or may not have exploited trusts specifically within Alaska because of the limited, although disturbing, view of the Pandora Papers. What do you say to policymakers in states where a limited degree of leaks have suggested that the scope of this problem could be significant, but we won't understand its full scope until there are greater transparency laws? How do we address this uncertainty?
Thank you for that question. And through the chair, that's a very, again, very important question to look at. Like was mentioned also in GFI's research, we only know what is in the public currently. We can only, the research that GFI did was based on real estate money laundering cases that are in the public domain. And those are cases that were reported by journalists such as the Pandora Papers or law enforcement actions. But we don't know what else is out there. And an important reason for that is because we don't know across the United States who owns these properties or who owns these legal entities or trusts. And therefore, the Pandora Papers, but also GFI research, is really just the tip of the iceberg. And it's really looking for a grain of salt or a small grain of salt in the dark room without knowing who else is behind these entities. So it's very, very important that we do get insight into that. And as we know, we are already seeing cases in places where we weren't necessarily expecting real estate money laundering, such as Alaska, and that only points to the issue that it's much, likely a much bigger problem that we're actually aware of.
Thanks. I do have an additional question. Whatever happened to Kenneth Zong, the individual identified as a money launderer in Alaska?
Thank you for the question. He was indicted, and his properties across Alaska, but also elsewhere in the United States, were fortunately seized because it was proven to have been purchased with money that he received for helping the Iranian government evade sanctions.
Thank you. Representative Spanholz.
Yeah, thank you. So I have a question. If Kenneth Zong was indicted, how was it that his fraud and laundering was identified?
Thank you for the question. I don't know the specifics of how exactly law enforcement detected this case. So I can't answer that question entirely, but I do know that once there is a lead on someone, only then you can start pulling the thread and find out what other properties someone owns. And something that is very helpful in that is having more beneficial ownership information behind those entities. But in the specific case of Kenneth Zong, I don't have the particular details, but I'd be happy to look into that further and get back to you on that later stage.
Thanks, Mr. Bell. I see Rob Schmidt is here with DCCED. Are you able to help answer this question, Mr. Schmidt? I know you're here for another bill, but thanks for offering your expertise.
Good morning, and for the record, my name is Robert Schmidt. I'm the Director of the Division of Banking and Securities. I would invite the committee's attention to a press release issued by the U.S. Attorney for the District of Alaska announcing the indictment of Mr. Zong. I reviewed it briefly while I was listening to this testimony. My understanding of quickly reviewing the press release is that Mr. Zong laundered money in Korea, and then the money came into, among other places, Anchorage. And he, Mr. Zong, and his son invested it. Mr. Zong, at the time of the press release in 2021, was serving time in Korea for violating Korea's money laundering laws. And there was also police action, law enforcement action being taken by not only Korea, but the United Arab Emirates and the Republic of Georgia. So it was very much the nation Georgia, not Georgia, the United States state. So he laundered money in Korea. Once he then brought the clean money into the United States. He laundered money and invested it. So it was ill-gotten gains of money laundering that happened in Korea. At any rate, there is a public press release, January 5th, 2021, U.S. Attorney's Office, District of Alaska.
Thanks, Mr. Schmidt. Do you have additional questions?
Thank you. So is it your understanding, and you may not be able to answer this question, that essentially our ability to prosecute in the U.S. was driven by other governments' prosecution, or was there something that we were able to document in the U.S. that allowed us to prosecute?
The fact that the indictment happened when he was already in jail in Korea suggests that the Korean action significantly predated any law enforcement action in America. The press release also talks about the prosecution would not have been possible but for coordination with the law enforcement agencies of other countries.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. If members don't have additional questions for Ms. DeBell, next up in invited testimony on House Bills 405 and 406, we have a video from Andres Knobel with Global Financial Integrity that provides some additional background.
Good morning. My name is Andres Knobel. I am the lead researcher on the Travel Machine. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you about some of the risks created by trusts and how to address these risks. We We at the Dexter Stanford believe that the tax and financial systems of the world are powerful tools to create just societies. But unfortunately, under the pressure of corporate giants to support, our governments have programmed these systems to bypass the wealthiest over everybody else. And this has created financial secrecy, which unfortunately also fosters corruption and undermines democracy. Now, even though that's pretty bad, governments, as we've heard for, still have a chance to reprogram their tax and financial systems to actually help the people. So what are the risks created by trusts? Although many trusts are actually used for legal and legitimate purposes, trusts have two specific properties, basically the secrecy and the asset protection property, that can be exploited by anyone. And this includes criminals, money launderers, anyone trying to avoid a sanction list. And the problem with trust secrecy is that not even authorities may know how many trusts exist in the world, the assets that these trusts hold, or even the people who benefit and hide behind these trusts. Let me give you some examples. This was a recent article published by The Guardian about a Russian oligarch, Alisher Usmanov, who is under the list of sanctions, but still, according to The Guardian, it is believed that he has placed hundreds of millions of pounds into an irrevocable trust, which would potentially leave them outside the sanctions regime, which basically means he would be affected by the sanctions. Another case of the U.S., as reported by the Washington Post, refers to a Texas billionaire who is alleged to have paid over $2 billion, and that makes it the largest ever tax fraud case against an individual in the U.S. And as Bloomberg describes in the figure that you can see, many of this tax evasion scheme actually involved many different trusts. There's one charitable trust from Bermuda, another one from Belize, and another one that's not clear where it is based from. Now, a lot of these cases tend to be more equitable cases that we find out sometimes by chance. Other cases, it's usually during divorce proceedings that we can find out that a trust either exists. And this lack of information on trust, lack of evidence, is also exemplified by two very famous reports. One is by the World Bank and the UNODC on the public masters of grand corruption cases, where even though these 10 investigations of grand corruption involved most companies, investigators interviewed said that these grand corruption investigations failed to capture the true strengths to which trusts are used. And the reason for that is that investigators and prosecutors tend not to bring charges against trust just because of the difficulty in proving all the crime. So at times, trust has simply not been mentioned in proceedings or tax court. At the same time, the FATF and the FMA group, they wrote a paper on consumer intellectual ownership, and this had to do with anti-money laundering and addressing the financing of terrorism, and they reached very similar conclusions. And what they explained is that the interaction of the trust with other persons adds an additional layer of complexity, and this helps foster efforts to discover the beneficial ownership, meaning natural persons who ultimately own, control, or benefit from assets or companies or entities. And again, in the same case, this also explains the relatively low prevalence in the case study sample of trusts. And that is simply because authorities are not aware of their existence. Now, what is the solution and what is your role here and what could you help achieve? The main thing we're asking for and promoting is to require trust registration. And this should happen in order for the trust to obtain legal validity. This already happens in Puerto Rico, the Czech Republic, and France, to give some examples. Ideally, trust registration will be required whenever a trust is created or is governed according to local laws, in this case, according to Alaska laws, whenever a trust has local assets or operations, in this case, in Alaska, or whenever any of the parties, say the central, trustee, protector, or beneficiary, are located in the jurisdiction. Argentina, where I'm based, already applies this third trigger. And it's, of course, important that the trust registration will also include information on the beneficial owners and the number of persons holding to own or control a benefit from trusts for every part of the trust that is an entity. So if a beneficiary is an entity, then the beneficiary should disclose who the beneficial owners are. Implementation is already happening in the world. The FATF, which is in charge of United Nations laundering recommendations and also against financing terrorism, will work in 2022 to improve recommendation 25 that deals precisely with beneficial ownership for trusts so as to upgrade the recommendation. And one of our research flagship projects, the Financial Secrecy Index that is published, that will be published in 2022, will show that more than 50 jurisdictions already require trusts to register. Among them, all EU countries and the UK, as well as other countries, also require trusts to register their beneficial owners, so that is third parties up to a natural person. And the EU, based on the directive, is already contemplating access to information by authorities and banks, and by anyone with a legitimate interest. But the interesting thing here is that the EU is going beyond this to information on trusts. Example of extract from the data.
Let's take a brief at ease while the while we try to work on connect. Labor and Commerce.
Abused for the wrong reasons. In 2006, Australia complained to New Zealand because it had a concern that New Zealand trusts were used by Australians to avoid tax. As a consequence of this, New Zealand started requiring trust registration if the Australia, if the settlement was from Australia.
Brief it is. In House Labor and Commerce. I think with the connectivity issues, we're going to work on getting this testimony on the record. Do committee members have additional questions for me or for my staff at this time on House Bills 405 or 406? Okay, thanks. I do want to clarify for stakeholders who may be watching that we are working on some amendments. The ATEP, Trust Professionals Group, recommended a different way of approaching the problems identified in that House Bill 406 attempts to address. So we're working on that draft language. We've heard from other stakeholders and are working with amendments. If you have amendments or ideas on how to make these bills work as well as possible and achieve their goal, please let me know. The amendment deadline is Tuesday at 3:15. I also want to clarify for stakeholders, the intent with House Bill 405 is not to provide public transparency of every trust beneficiary. It is to provide oversight through the department. So DCCED would be able to review who trust beneficiaries are, review those individuals against the sanctions list, and as necessary, make referrals to the Department of the Treasury and the Office of Foreign Asset Control. That does not mean publicly disclosing who's in a trust, and I think that distinction is important. So not seeing further questions, I'm going to turn to House Bill 408, an administration bill, which also addresses issues of transparency, financial integrity, thanks to staff at the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development for developing this bill. And I believe Director Schmidt is here to explain House Bill 408 to the committee.
For the record, my name is Robert Schmidt, and I'm the director of the Division of Banking and Securities. Before I begin, there is a lot going on in this bill, and there's a lot of complicated concepts in here. I would encourage members of the committee to freely interrupt me if you have questions as we move along. I also think that it might be useful to provide a very brief historical analysis that will be useful as we go along. Money transmission. Imagine you're back in 1880 and you're in Boston and you would like to wire to your cousin in San Francisco the princely sum of $20. You go to, say, Western Union or wherever the money transmitter is. You give them the $20 and you place faith in them that the $20 will reach your cousin in San Francisco minus a predetermined fee. It is that act of trust, placing your money in the hands of others, that it resulted in money transmission being regulated in the first place. So, moving forward, the Division of Banking and Securities serves as the primary regulator for over 150 money transmitters in Alaska. These money transmitters follow the Alaska Uniform Money Services Act, ASO 655, which was passed by the legislature in 2007 and implemented in 2008. The bill being discussed today is the Alaska Uniform Money Transmission Modernization Act. This legislation amends and modernizes the Alaska Uniform Money Services Act. The act provides the legal framework for money transmission functions, including currency exchange, transfer or wiring of money, and loading and reloading of payment instruments, including stored value cards. When passed in 2007, the act did not contemplate virtual or cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or the rate of money service business expansion and innovations. And we're going to talk quite a bit more about virtual currency and cryptocurrency in a bit. This legislation updates the licensing, record keeping, and enforcement provisions to support these business activities and protect Alaska consumers. This bill adopts pertinent sections of the Uniform Money Transmission Modernization Act, which was developed by state regulators, the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, and with input and participation from industry stakeholders. On that note, since I've been sitting here in this committee room, we have received a letter of unconditional support from the Money Service Business Association of America addressed to the co-chairs supporting House Bill 408. When the current act went into effect in 2008, money transmission was sending a wire transfer at your local grocery store or purchasing a money order or traveler's checks at the bank. This bill will modernize Alaska's money transmission laws to include cryptocurrency, also known as virtual currency, such as Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Dogecoin. Alaska does not currently regulate cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency is one of the top tools of rogue actors, such as Russian oligarchs, North Korean kleptocrats, to evade sanctions. 28 states currently regulate cryptocurrency. I would also say that the model law that we are talking about today has been passed and adopted in West Virginia. It was only finalized by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors in September of last year. It has been introduced in many other states, and we expect further adoption over the coming months. When passed in 2007, the act did not contemplate virtual or cryptocurrency or the rates of money service business expansion. This legislation updates the licensing, record keeping, and enforcement provisions to support these business activities and protect Alaska consumers. In the past, the division has found licensed money transmitters of fiat currency, which is a fancy way to say real money, that have had very poor compliance with the Bank Secrecy Act and Office of Foreign Asset Controls. If companies do not have a compliance management system in place, Alaskans could be scammed, and the funds they send may not be received by their intended recipients. Alaska participates in a multi-state money transmitter examination system using a risk-based approach to streamline state supervision to be more effective and efficient in utilizing state resources. An examination, what my staff does, is a review of companies' compliance with applicable state and federal laws and regulations and areas deemed likely to affect the safety and soundness of the licensee. DBS staff reviews the financial condition, business model, internal controls and auditing, management, systems and technology, and compliance management system of a licensee. Utilizing network supervision with other states allows us to reduce regulatory burden on companies by conducting less frequent examinations and reducing the time, travel, and expense for the licensee and the department. Examinations ensure that policies and procedures are being followed and consumers are protected. Now to get to the real interesting part. Money transmission. The most common form of money transmission in 2022 is, to me anyway, would be PayPal, Venmo, Zelle, that sort of activity. Money transmission in Alaska keeps growing. As of December 31st, 2021, Alaska had 153 money transmitter licenses, with 40 of those conducting virtual currency business activity that is not currently regulated. Over the last 5 years, money transmission licenses have increased 68%. I want to take a moment and we're going to get into some really interesting data, and I need to explain the three different buckets where this data comes from. The first bucket is a company that only does real money transmission, fiat currency. We issue them a license, and we periodically examine them. The second bucket that is becoming much more common is a company that does both real money and they do virtual currency money transmission. With those, we will issue them a license to transmit real money, but then we specifically enter into an agreement with them that says Alaska does not regulate virtual currency, and you're not allowed to hold yourself out as being licensed or approved by the state of Alaska to handle real or virtual currency. The third bucket is all they do is virtual currency, and they don't get licensed, they don't get regulated under the current law. Moving on to the next slide, this is annual Alaska money transmission volume. These numbers are from bucket one, the real money transmitters, and bucket two, the real money plus virtual currency. This data does not include bucket three, people that only do virtual currency. Money transmission.
Mr. Schmidt, yes. I apologize. Yes. Representative Snyder has a question.
Yes, yes, I'm sorry.
Taking you up on your suggestion of interrupting you, thank you. Could you just provide an example of business names that we might recognize that handle these different buckets?
PayPal, Venmo, Zelle, Stripe, Western Union, Robinhood. Have I mentioned some that...
Plenty. Yes.
Okay.
For clarity, those are the
big actors
of the real money.
Each of those is at least in the first bucket of real money, and most of those are in the middle bucket of virtual and real money. And just wait until we get to the next slide. Holy moly! All right. So this slide here is bucket one and bucket two. Money transmission in Alaska, that is reported to us, has gone from $1.7 billion in 2019, grew a bunch, $2.8 billion in 2020, and then put your seatbelt on, $7.1 billion in 2021. Key and important, none of bucket three is in here. So if you only do virtual currency transmission, you're not in here. This does include bucket two, both virtual and real money. Moving on to the next slide. Yes, just please.
So, Mr. Schmidt, I thought you said that this bill would not regulate companies who do only virtual currency. Did I misunderstand that? And that the intention, that's the current law, and that the intention of the bill is to incorporate in those who only do virtual currency?
That is correct, that we are intending to bring in virtual currency to the regulated sphere of money transmission.
All right, thank you.
This is the growth, looking at the next slide, in virtual currency transmission in Alaska that is reported to us. So again, we're talking about bucket one and bucket two, none of bucket three. This number that we are looking at is a floor. There was $33.6 million of virtual currency transmitted in Alaska in 2019. There was $91.7 million of virtual currency transmitted within Alaska in 2020. And then it absolutely exploded to $2.3 billion in 2021. As we were looking at, after the this bill was adopted by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, my staff was coming to me with partial year data for 2021 saying something is going on here. These numbers that we're getting are just astronomical. And then when we finally, it's February or March of this year that we finally got full year data back from the companies for 2021. And this picture is just astonishing, the volume of virtual currency that is happening in Alaska. The other thing that I should mention is that,
Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Chair Fields. Just to further highlight my need for education, I understand virtual currency and cryptocurrency are different things, but in the introductory page, there's a backslash in between. Can you draw a distinction between those two, please?
I use the phrase interchangeably for purposes of this discussion. I apologize.
Representative Thomas.
Yeah, so what did happen between 2020 and 2021 that resulted in this exponential growth in crypto use in Alaska?
Thank you so much for the question. That was going to be my next comment. Because we don't regulate virtual currency, we never look at these businesses on their virtual currency products. And we never get to examine them. And so we don't have a good ability to tell you what is going on. I have received data at the company level where we have companies that were doing a few thousand or tens of thousands of dollars of virtual currency transmission in 2020 that are doing tens of millions of dollars of virtual currency transmission in Alaska in 2021. We have virtual currency transmitters that have gone from $2 million a few years ago to six to nine, some tens of millions of dollars. One of the biggest virtual currency transmitters in 2021, it was less than $100 million. They grew to over $1 billion of virtual currency transmission in 2022. And again, because we don't regulate this, because we don't examine this, we don't know. I will say virtual currency price is very dynamic. It's gone up a lot in value. It's being utilized more. However, I am not comfortable saying that the increase in value of virtual currency and Alaskans doing more virtual currency transmission, that alone explains this growth.
So you may not be able to disclose which companies are doing this, but could you describe some of the industries where you're seeing the growth?
The data that is being reported to us on virtual currency is only from the bucket two, and we do not have any sense. The data that is being disclosed to us, at least that I am aware of, does not say, for example, this much is happening in tourism or this much is happening in natural resources. So we just don't have a sense of that.
All right. Thank you.
My esteemed colleague, Melissa.
Representative,
yes, please.
Yeah, just as I think about this, thank you through the chair. I mean, do you know if other states are seeing this kind of growth? I mean, we're not an anomaly, are we, or do we even know?
Through the chair, I have a limited understanding of this, talking to colleagues and other people throughout the country. When I do explain to them Alaska's growth, we are a standout. Is my current understanding that yes, the industry is growing, but even in that context, we are a standout. And yes, that concerns me.
Thank you.
Representative Bonnell has a question.
Could you give us a sense of scale in terms of how we're standing out?
That's
difficult, but do your best, I guess.
I will tell you where I get this impression from. I have spoken with 3, 4, or 5 different industry groups or people who are involved at a national level, and everybody has a sense of this is growing and this is big. When I tell them our numbers, they are surprised. Mm-hmm. To everyone that I've spoken to, that I have shown or discussed the numbers that are on the current slide shown, they are surprised by this level of growth.
All right, thank you.
And just reiterate, because we do not regulate this, and we do not perform any examinations. These numbers, other than what is being reported to us, anything behind these numbers is very opaque. Let's see. So as discussed, this graph shows the explosive growth of reported annual virtual currency transmission in Alaska. Remember, there's none of bucket three in this. There's only buckets one and, or only bucket two here. Reported virtual currency transmission in Alaska grew 6,782% from 2019 to 21, and it grew 2,420% in 2021 alone. Virtual currency transactions have fundamentally changed the financial services world and are having exponential growth in Alaska. This bill will add virtual currency activities to the definition of money transmission to allow DBS to regulate this activity that accounted for nearly one-third of the total money transmission volume in Alaska in 2021. Please note that based on licensing inquiries from companies that have only virtual currency activity, we expect reported volume to increase significantly when this bill goes into effect. Moving on to the next slide. This bill does contain a fiscal note, and I'd like to take a moment to talk about the DBS's, the Division of Banking and Securities, revenue picture. The division's receipts have grown 53% from fiscal year 2012 to fiscal year 2021, and our revenues are not only growing, they are accelerating. Receipts in fiscal year 2021 were $19.6 million. In calendar year 2021, our receipts were $21.5 million, and the division's budget is only $4 million. Our budget, and I believe it was fiscal year 2012, our budget was $3.5 million. The division will require additional staff and support costs to respond to the growth in the money service activities, the complexity of new business models, and use of third-party partnerships. The positions will allow the division to implement the new law, incorporate changes in the operation of the NMLS system, that's the Nationwide Multi-State Licensing System, develop proficiency in the examination of electronic systems and assessment of cybersecurity measures in a high-risk environment. New program receipt revenue is estimated to be at the low end, a minimum of $110,000 for 35 new license applications by fiscal year 2025. It is difficult to anticipate the number of new applications and annual renewal fees and assessments and resulting revenue for future years. However, the division expects to adopt an assessment fee model through new regulations that would ensure actual costs of supervision of the industry would be covered through annual program receipts and is expected to range between $750,000 to $1.2 million. It is important to note that as part of the regulations that will implement this bill, the division anticipates adopting a volume-based licensing fee. So if you are one of the big boys, the PayPals, Venmos, they are far bigger than the small money transmitters. So there would be a fee based on your volume, which would be appropriate for smaller local Alaskan businesses. Why change the act? The current law has not kept up with the industry's explosive growth and innovation. The consumer protection is insufficient. Every regulator that has commented on top threats facing investors identifies cryptocurrency and other digital assets as one of the highest risks for fraud. And with the current act, virtual currency is not included in the definition of money transmission. Moving on, what does this bill do? It'll reduce regulatory burden by streamlining initial licensing and license renewal, utilizing the Nationwide Multi-State System and Registry. I expect that if you've ever seen an ad for somebody trying to sell a mortgage, you see in fine print, NMLS number thus and such. NMLS is a system that was developed in the late 2000s following the Great Recession. It was originally intended for the mortgaging industry. It's now grown to include licensing and registration for all kinds of financial industries. I will tell you, my staff loves this. I had I met with my licensing staff person who does the licensing for money service businesses. He pulled out a giant three-ring binder stuffed full of papers, and he said, this is what an application used to look like before NMLS, and it was tabbed, and I had to pull everything apart, and I had to scan it. Now with NMLS, it is all digitized. It is uniform, and he is greatly in favor of NMLS.
Yeah, question on this.
Yes, Representative Funnels.
Yeah, so one of the letters we've received, I believe, in opposition to this bill is from the payroll group and the Independent Payroll Providers Association, and they're concerned that this bill essentially brings payroll processors into the NMLS, and that they don't currently participate in this. Could you address that?
To speak broadly, payroll processing is currently within the scope of the existing money transmission bill. So there may be differences in business models that might take a particular business out of payroll processing, but broadly speaking, payroll processing is covered by the current bill.
By the current law or the bill?
By the current law. Okay. Current law includes payroll processing. And I should state very clearly that payroll processing is in no way a problematic industry. There is nothing about them that we are highlighting them for enhanced scrutiny. Having said that, they are in a position of trust and of handling other people's money. In the last 10 years, there's been $500 million of documented theft within the payroll processing industry. Payroll processing in Alaska is not being singled out at all here, but they do remain in a position of trust. One attribute of the payroll processing industry that is a little bit different, the criminal prosecutions have shown that the payroll processing industry, particularly if one were to be fraudulent, if one were to be a bad actor, it does lend itself to a Ponzi scheme. In these scams that have come public, what we've seen is a literal robbing of Peter to pay Paul sort of situation, where you're covering one employer's payroll with another employer's fund. Again, there is nothing about the state of Alaska payroll processing industry that I believe warrants heightened scrutiny. It's merely a matter of they're already included in the existing law, and they would be within the NMLS system in this proposed bill.
So, Paul?
Yes.
So they're not they don't currently participate in the NMLS. Sorry, I'm struggling with that acronym. They don't currently participate, and they would be required to do so. Do they already have to register or get licensed in the state of Alaska in any way?
We do currently have payroll processors that are licensed, but I would also like to defer to Tracy Reno, who is my chief of examinations, and she is available on the phone, if she could comment a bit on the licensing of payroll processors in Alaska currently.
I think Ms. Reno maybe was on, but is not on presently, so we can get back to her at a subsequent hearing, perhaps.
Okay.
Do you have additional questions, Representative Funnels?
No, I think I just need some follow-up information. This is one of the kind of red flags that was brought to the committee, and I just want to make sure that I understand, the way they're currently regulated and the way that we're proposing to change and how that impacts. I'm less concerned about sort of national organizations. I'm more concerned about sort of mom and pop industries. We heard that there was essentially in West Virginia where they adopted something similar, that it would require bonding, pretty significant bonding, and that there were an average cost of about $50,000 per payroll processor. And I need more information and need to understand how this bill would potentially impact kind of those mom and pops. I'm not concerned about the big companies that can afford that, but if you're a individual bookkeeper that processes payroll, what is this going to cost you? What is the current regulatory status, and how would this change? And so, thanks.
Thank you. And through the chair, I would share that yesterday, I, my staff, and also a representative of the Conference of State Bank Supervisors spent almost 3 hours with Senator Keel. And it was, we specifically did discuss some changes to the bill that would be appropriate for Alaska and would be along the nature of reducing entry barriers in a way that's appropriate for Alaska, the size of our economy, the size of our businesses that might not be appropriate, for example, in, you know, Massachusetts, California, or where have you.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, I think I'd like to learn a little bit more about that.
You bet. All right. This bill will protect Alaska consumers by conducting criminal background checks through the nationwide multi-state licensing system on individuals who control a money transmission business. Please note that currently background checks are done by the Division of Banking and Securities staff using third-party software. This takes about 140 hours of staff time a year to just do the criminal background checks. This bill will ensure regulatory costs of supervision keep pace with growth by allowing implementation of a volume-based assessment. Licensees will be required to report money transmission volume, which will ensure licensees are treated fairly and equitably based on the level of volume and business conducted in the state. And again, this bill will broaden the definition of money transmission to include virtual currency transactions and other methods of moving or transferring monetary value to better protect Alaskans. This bill provides consumer protection for Alaskans. It will require licensees to comply with federal laws, including suspicious activity reporting. It will increase the record retention schedule to 5 years for greater transparency, allow criminal background checks to be run on licensees. It will update enforcement provisions by allowing a broader spectrum of orders to be issued. It will ensure the division can coordinate with other states in all areas of regulation, licensing, and supervision to reduce regulatory burden on the industry and more effectively utilize regulator resources. I really can't emphasize this point enough. My staff relies heavily on our contacts in equivalent agencies and other states. Allowing us to leverage a nationwide system such as this would be very important. And this will define crypto and virtual currency money transmission activities and allow the regulation of these activities to protect Alaska consumers. This bill will define virtual currency and add that business activity to the definition of money transmission requiring licensure and supervision. The definition is in the bill at ASO 655-290, subsection 5. Virtual currency is a money-like asset that is managed, stored, or exchanged on computer systems and transmitted by the internet. Virtual currency is issued and controlled by its developers and used and accepted electronically among the members of a specific virtual community. It is accepted by natural or legal persons as a means of payment and can be stored, transferred, or traded electronically. That concludes my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to take any further questions you might have, and I sincerely appreciate the committee's time and attention.
Thanks, Mr. Schmidt. Representative Snyder.
My understanding is, with my cursory understanding with NFTs, for example, digital assets are typically bought and sold using cryptocurrency. Do you have any sense of the degree to which NFT transfers, the role they play in this large increase you've seen in virtual currency transmission?
I have no data that I have no rigorous data to support it other than to say NFTs are all the rage. I've got a 17-year-old son and a 20-year-old son, and if they're buying NFTs like they're buying sneakers, there's a lot of it out there. That is not scientific. That is not rigorous. Yes, I intend that somewhat to be humorous. I would like to have data that I could point to, but there is significant activity in that space.
I want to get a follow-up, Representative Snyder.
On a different topic, I can get back in here.
Okay. Representative Sponholz, Tracy Reno is online. So if you could re-ask your question, then we'll go to Representative Shiragi and back to Snyder.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Reno, for getting back on the line. I think we there was one of the letters of opposition that we received to the bill was from the Independent Payroll Providers Association, and they were concerned that payroll processing companies were getting incorporated into HB 408 in a way that would require them to participate in the NMLS. I have to do that slow every single time for some reason. And that would potentially result in sort of, you know, a higher regulatory burden. And I wanted to kind of understand what is currently required of payroll processors in the state of Alaska and what would be required under House Bill 408 if it were to be passed. And my particular lens is really focusing in not on like the large companies, but the small kind of mom and pop payroll processors that might do like bookkeeping and process payroll for a few companies, you know, as like independent practitioners. So that's kind of my key focus there.
Thank you, Susie Co-Chair. This is Tracy Reno for the record. I'm the Chief of Examinations with the Division of Banking and Securities. And payment processors are not exempt currently in the current Act for money transmitter licensing. We have several that are licensed currently with the state of Alaska. I believe what we wanted to do in this bill is to make it clear and specifically call that out, that they are required to be licensed in the state of Alaska, and that we wanted to make sure it was transparent to them so that they knew that they, what the requirements would be. And so, I also just want to let you know that we have, Matt Lambert with the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. He helps draft the model law and is very well versed in national money transmission, situations. So he may be able to speak to it also. He's very familiar with the payment processor, concerns, but they're not currently exempt. They do require licensing in Alaska. We do have a couple that are licensed. The bill will just clarify and state it clearly that that is a requirement for licensure for those types of industries. And then there's fees that are paid. The NMLS system allows us to have online electronic applications and renewals and being able to pay payments. So it streamlines the process so that it's the same for everyone across the nation. So it reduces burden on the companies that have to, that are required to do licensing. It makes it the same way across each state. And so it's not unique to just Alaska. It would be the same across all the states. If it's okay, I'd like to allow Matt to chime in just a little bit and see if he has anything that he'd like to add. I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thanks, Ms. Reno. Mr. Lambert, do you want to comment on that?
Thank you. The synopsis that Tracy just gave is pretty par for the course nationally. States, you know, they regulate money transmission, so money received for transmission, and you know, typically don't get into details about different business models. So when a company receives money for transmission, whether that's at a counter for a Western Union agent to send out of the country, or for payroll processing, the intent is to make sure that those funds are kept safe and they are there in the end. The reason that it got explicitly added, payroll got explicitly added to the model law, was a string of failures of payroll companies, most of which are had a background in fraud, and a lot of criminals, you know, going to jail because of what Director Schmidt described. Whether or not these were folks that had bad intentions at the outset or just became a way of covering losses, you know, it's a case-by-case thing. But both of those scenarios have come to light in the past decade. So it seemed important to make clear that if you receive money for transmission and are a payroll provider, you know, there's no payroll processor exemption.
So thank you. This is a follow-up, I guess, for Ms. Reno. So you said that there's a few payroll, that they're legally required to be licensed in the state of Alaska already, and we have a few that are currently doing so. That implies that there are a large number of them that are not doing so. And what is being proposed sounds to me like kind of a one-size-fits-all process. Can you describe what would be required to get, what is required to get licensed as a payroll processor in the state of Alaska?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Thank you. This is, for the record, Tracy Reno. So the licensing process for money transmitters, they pay a fee. They're required to go into the NMLS and fill out information about their business, provide financial statements, their business plan, provide the information of the people that own the company, and then those that are in control and make decisions for the company. Those people do not currently have background checks run through the system. We do that manually in our office. So this bill would allow us to run criminal background checks through the FBI for all money transmitters, again, for owners and for individuals who make those decisions for the company. They also are required to do quarterly reporting on their volume and then annual reporting for audited financial statements. We have a set surety bond right now, and in the proposed bill, there is a sliding scale, if you will, for volume-based or asset-based businesses. So what we tried to do in the bill is, while we want to take in consideration the risk based for national or international companies, we also want to be concerned about the mom and pops, and we don't want to have a barrier to entry. So we are having a sliding scale for the surety bonds for net worth. We're looking at, we have a proposal to raise that, but we have had some concerns about that may be a barrier to entry. So we're going to take a look at that and see if we can lower that back down a little bit to where people think it's a better fit. We've been listening to industry groups and some, like you said, there's been some money transmitters or payroll processors that have reached out and have expressed some concerns. So there is some minor adjustments that we're looking at amending the bill. So we think that will be a better fit for those concerns. Also, annually, there will be renewals required. And again, the assessments for renewals, they're currently a flat base fee, no matter what size volume you have. If you're a couple thousand dollars in Alaska, or whether you're $1 billion in Alaska volume, you pay the same amount. So we're looking at doing assessments to be risk-based based on the size and volume of the company. So we're trying to have a better fit for those smaller businesses and the larger businesses in Alaska.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Reno. Let's go to Representative, back to Representative Snyder, and then after this question, I do want to return to this bill, but I think maybe I want to move on to the next bill just for now, because we do have to take up and pass Representative Snyder's bill. So, Representative Snyder.
Just thinking about everyday Alaskans, we've heard some concerns about some of our smaller businesses engaged in payroll. How might the everyday Alaskan, if at all, feel the impact of this bill? I understand you've highlighted some consumer protection, but just in everyday utilization of some of these money transfer companies.
If the last 2 years have taught me anything, it is that my crystal ball is broken. And if I were to have been asked about virtual currency years ago, I would have said, this is monopoly money. This is not a thing. This is not going to go anywhere. And I would have been very, very wrong. It is my expectation that virtual currency will continue to increase as a means of payment. I wouldn't be surprised at all if, frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if this summer you see businesses here in Juneau that have a sign outside that would say, we will take your payments in Bitcoin. We will accept payments in virtual currency. That is simply coming. It is, people are more and more comfortable utilizing virtual currency. They appreciate the confidentiality that virtual currency provides. There are plenty of international tourists that would love to avoid money exchange issues. Virtual currency is going to be used more and more and more and more. And so this bill would increase the confidence that consumers can have, that it would increase the confidence that virtual currency is not the Wild West, that it is being appropriately regulated, that they can have faith in the systems to get the money where it's going to go in an appropriate way.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. This bill does have a long sectional analysis, so I hope that we can return to this bill and spend some time on it and feel confident. I hope to take action on it. So thanks for all your work on it and your colleagues' work on it.
Thank you very much for the committee's time. I sincerely appreciate it.
Our final bill today is House Bill 392 from Representative Snyder. We did not receive any amendments. We do need to take public testimony on the bill, so at this time I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 392. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to offer public testimony? Not seeing any. Is there anyone online who wishes to offer public testimony? If not, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 392. Does the sponsor have any additional remarks before we take action on this bill?
No. Thank you, Chair Fields.
Okay. Representative Funnels.
I move House Bill 392, version 32-LS1561-B from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 392 passes from committee. Please remember to sign the paperwork. Thanks to everyone for sitting through a very busy meeting today. I think we've completed our business, and at 10:40 a.m., House Labor and Commerce is adjourned.